Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
While we're in New York for Climate Week, I'm thrilled to welcome David A. Andelman, a distinguished foreign correspondent who has held key roles at major media outlets, including the New York Times, CBS News, and CNBC. Currently, he's a contributor to CNN and blogs for his very popular Substack called Andelman Unleashed. We're looking forward to dive into his wealth of experience and insights on international journalism, global politics, and energy policy. David, what an honor to have you here in New York during Climate Week. Look forward to having this conversation. Thanks for being with us on Path to Zero.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a great honor, and especially the day of the debut of your marvelous new book.
It's been a really interesting day, but let's talk about you for a little bit.
You bet.
You've really had a great career as a foreign correspondent. You've worked for some of the most prestigious newspapers, broadcast networks around the world. You've reported from or traveled through, I think at our count, more than 85 countries.
More than 90 now.
Yeah, it's more than 90 now, I'll take that. Is there a particular news source that you've interviewed that really stands out as being maybe exceptionally difficult, or even one that surprised you with how forthcoming they were with the facts and the data?
I got two for you. Two of them I've had most interesting relationships. First was Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan dictator. Mm-hmm. And I found him fascinating because I've interviewed him a couple of times in Libya back in the 1980s when Reagan was actually bombing Tripoli and when he was worried about what was going to happen next to his country. So he invited me down there, and I came down. And we get into his room where he's ready to set up for the interview. He's not there. And we're sitting there, and there's this big curtain behind him. And all of a sudden, a phalanx of Amazonian women guards with machine guns come trotting out in their fatigues and surround us behind us. And then we wait a few more minutes, and in sweeps Gaddafi himself with a floor-length white gown tied at the throat with a gold ribbon. And he sits down, and he sweeps around, and he says, "Well, how may I be of assistance to you?" And I said, "Well, you can answer a few of my questions." So he did. And then when it's ended, he jumps up. The same thing happens in reverse. He goes out. The Amazonians follow him. And it was quite a spectacle, I must say. And the second one, though, was much more interesting in some ways. The other extreme, François Mitterrand, the president of France for 14 years, the longest-serving French president under the Fifth Republic. He was at once, I think, the smartest and most genuine human politician I've ever met. He was an extraordinary individual. There was one time when we were interviewing him in the gardens of the Élysée, and our cameraman had just become a citizen of France that very day, that morning. He was sworn in. And I whispered this to Mitterrand, "You know, our cameraman is your newest citizen of the French Republic." My goodness. So he goes over to Joe. He throws his arm around him. And he says, kisses him on both cheeks. I said, "I want to welcome you to La Patrie, the country." Takes him by the arm and shows him around the entire Élysée Gardens, pointing out all the statues and everything else. Joe is beyond, just immeasurably happy. So that was the kind of person he was. And those are the two extremes of people that I've encountered, of many.
What a great pair of stories. And I can't imagine the security getting in to see Gaddafi.
Oh, yeah.
So here in New York for Climate Week, let's talk about maybe one of your recent articles for CNN focused on climate policy in Paris. You've lived there for quite some time. I know you have an American home as well. But tell our listeners about Paris's travails to this car-free world they want to live in.
Well, it's frankly a vision of the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, that some people consider a bit of a nightmare, because what she decided was to, first of all, ban all cars from the banks of the River Seine, where they used to be able to travel freely through Paris, almost like an expressway through the city, and then expanding pedestrian and bike lanes on a host of other thoroughfares. All this restricting Paris down to just a couple of lanes on some of what used to be major thoroughfares. And the congestion has been remarkable. I mean, it's been really, if you talk to a taxi driver in Paris, every single one of them hates the mayor. Now, that's not to say that there haven't been some benefits, because there have. I had lunch today with Tony Renucci, who's the head of Respire, one of the major, climate organizations in Paris that worries about air quality. And he said over the last 20 years, the last of which were, you know, really dramatically changing in terms of the auto traffic in Paris. He said the Paris pollution has dropped by over 50%, the air pollution. And it really is quite extraordinary what that's done. But the problem is the social and city planning consequences of that have been so horrific that a lot of people really have not embraced this concept at all.
Yeah, the social consequences probably are more. And if a person's trying to deliver a package or groceries, they're still subject to the same ban, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, no vehicles in that area.
Well, exactly. And everybody, and that's the problem, because you've compressed to one or two lanes on lanes, thoroughfares that used to be four or five lanes wide. You compressed all of the traffic, buses, cars, private cars, Ubers, taxis, everything, all into these two lanes. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Really honored to talk to you because I think you're a really good expert to talk about France's approach to climate issues, maybe compared to other nations in Europe. I often think about Germany, but also perhaps compare France to the United States. Where do you see us similar and where do you see us much different?
Well, the principal difference is in terms of nuclear power. France has truly embraced nuclear power.
And they have for a long time.
They have, yes. And it's not they're not disembracing themselves from it. They continue to embrace it. Two-thirds of all electric power in France is generated by nuclear power plants. And that compares to Slovakia. That's the next at 61%. Then they drop off rapidly. Hungary is in third place with 49% of its electricity from nuclear. Finland at 42%. We have barely 19% in the U.S. and less than 14% in Canada being produced by nuclear power. And I mean, that is dramatic, 19% versus 64%. That's a dramatic change, dramatic difference. And at the same time, France is ramping up other carbon-friendly production. It has 60 offshore wind farm projects en route and is expected to be fully carbon neutral by 2050, probably a lot sooner if Macron and his successors, President Macron and his successors have their way.
With a relatively stable power grid and, I guess, relatively stable pricing.
It is. The pricing has been very stable, remarkably stable, and at a fraction of the price here. We pay at our little place out in Pennsylvania, we can pay as much as $400 or $500 a month for electricity during the winter. That's mainly unfortunately, we have a propane system just for our emergency generator, not for the whole house.
We can fix that.
I'm sure you can. Okay, that would be interesting. But in Paris, for that same winter month, we pay maybe 40 or 50 euros, about $60, compared with 450 or $500 here.
Wow.
It's remarkably different, and I think that's the same. That's virtually the same for virtually every household in France.
Do you see any other differences between France and the rest of Europe?
Well, France is a unique country in many respects in Europe. First of all, it's managed to resist the far right, and politically. Which has been embraced by so many other countries in Europe. Originally, places like Austria and Hungary, Slovakia, Italy, for instance, has a far-right prime minister right now. And in Germany, there's a real swing right now to the far right. One of the things I do on my Substack page, Andelman Unleashed, is I look at and I cover every election everywhere in the world every year. And lately, this year alone, in three of the major state elections in Germany, the far right has come in ahead or tied with, the traditional parties. It has never happened before. I mean, this is a far right party that really traces its roots back to Nazism.
Right.
It's very scary. That has not come true in France and in, frankly, even in most other European countries, but it is starting.
Yeah. You've written a book. How many books have you written?
I've written five and translated one.
Wow. So your latest book, I believe, is called A Red Line in the Sand. You explore key moments where red lines shaped global conflicts. Talk to us about what a red line is and maybe the events that prompted you to write that book.
Well, red lines are a particular kind of formula that stipulate a geographic or a strategic line that separates two or more countries or beliefs that shall not be crossed without substantial penalties. So let me give you an example. The Korean line, the Korean truce line between North and South Korea, that has basically, it's resulted in peace along the Korean Peninsula since, really since the Korean War back in the 1950s. And there's no sense that that's going to be breached anytime soon, no matter all of the craziness that's coming out of Kim Jong-un and Pyongyang right now. So, I mean, his threat is more towards directly towards the United States rather than towards South Korea. Right. That's a red line that's worked. There have been other red lines that have not. Obama's red line over in Syria, for instance, you know, you shall not use mass destruction against your own people. You shouldn't use poisonous gas against your own people. And he turned around and used it. Bashar al-Assad, the ruler in Syria, turned around and used that almost immediately. And we basically did nothing to challenge that.
Right.
So that was left standing. So red lines are very important. There were red lines surrounding most of Russia and the Soviet Union that held until Putin invaded Ukraine. Now we have to figure out how we're going to stabilize those. So I thought it would be a most interesting exercise to look at these lines as they exist today. I've seen them in all the time I've been traveling all over the world, how they work and how they don't work. And this is a book to explain why they work and why they don't, and which ones can work.
And then you've kind of moved into a current world called Andelman Unleashed. You can find it on Substack for those who want to learn about more. What are you doing with Andelman Unleashed?
Well, I started originally by chronicling Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign as president of France in 2022, then decided it would be useful to look at every election around the world every year, so I began doing that. So far, I've reported on at least 100 elections in countries all over the world. Beyond that, though, I decided every week there are media around the world that are looking at the U.S. and forming their country's perceptions of us, their people's perceptions of us. And we never really look at that. So I began looking at those media all over the world and how they're looking at each other countries, neighboring countries, and so on as well. So I've started to do that every week. My 110th edition is coming out this coming weekend.
Huh.
So we've been, beyond that, it's whatever interests me. I'm launching a Unleash Cuisine on cuisine all over the world, you know, different countries and different times. Even Unleashed Memoir, excerpts from my memoirs that are in progress now called Don't Shoot, I'm an American Reporter.
So let's talk a little bit about some of that work you're doing. You talked about Germany moving quite a bit right of where they have been. Any other elections or coming up that really seem to surprise you? I find Austria is a bit surprising to me, perhaps.
Austria is surprising. I was just there, in fact, last fall. I've been in all of the Baltic countries, and then we came down and visited Liechtenstein, which was the last country in Europe I had never actually visited, which was fascinating, a tiny little country between Austria and Switzerland. So Austria is a surprise, and that's a disappointing surprise. I don't know. I mean, I think the principal question is going to be, can the United States fulfill its the deal it had made, really, basically, since the invasion of Ukraine, to help the Ukrainian people maintain a democracy in the face of an autocracy? And I think a lot of that will have to do with how we perform in November.
Yeah. And you've written, let's talk about Ukraine and Russia. You've written extensively about it. Love to hear your views on it, but I'd equally love to hear your views on Russian energy flowing into Europe, into India, perhaps into China. What you know and what you think about that?
Well, I think that, the West Europeans were seduced, shall we say, by very cheap prices of Russian oil and natural gas. The Russians, after all, are producing it themselves. They can lift natural gas and sell it virtually at cost and undercut virtually any other part of the world. They're also contiguously, they're the same land mass, so there's no, you can build a pipeline without any problems, but which they have done, between Russia and Western Europe, particularly Germany. They built a couple of them, and they can supply gas and oil, but mainly natural gas, very cheaply. So Western Europe got hooked on that. Now the question is, can they de-hook themselves? Can they de-link themselves? They've done a pretty good job of it so far, but it's not complete by any means.
France was not quite as vulnerable as Germany, Great Britain.
No, no. Well, France, remember, 65% of their of their energy use comes from nuclear.
And they were migrating already to other forms, right?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Germany, for sure, was hooked on it.
Right, Germany has had a hard time. But they have made some, and they're also building some big LNG plants, in deliquification plants in Germany, so that they can begin accepting liquefied natural gas from places like the United States and other locales.
You think they're accepting LNG from Russia?
No, probably.
Yeah, just in the last week, some of those phantom ships, I think, have been ratted out as probably Russian cargoes.
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt. No, Russia has done a remarkable job itself in finding other markets for its products. India, particularly, China, of course, North Korea. Some of the countries you would expect to be allies of an autocracy like Russia. But India is particularly upsetting to me personally. I have many friends who are Indians, and I think the Modi government has been it preaches a great democratic ideal, and it doesn't always follow through on it.
But don't you see that maybe as an opportunistic way to get cheap energy rather than a way to be aligned with Putin?
Oh, absolutely. But he has to understand that he is effectively aligning himself with Putin by making that pact with the devil. And he's made that pact.
You've seen that firsthand in Europe's view.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No
Interesting.
Question. I mean, look at the people he has in Europe that Putin has successfully wooed. Viktor Orban, the ruler of Hungary, which gets oil and natural gas at a fraction of the price the rest of Europe does. Yeah. And he is now, for this six-month period, he is the head of the European Union. It's a rotating six-month presidency.
Right.
So, coincidentally, he has Europe under his boot heel, effectively. Not effectively. Yeah. Hopefully he won't be able to.
Do you see a reordering of the world alliances based on energy? Where I just suppose American LNG going into certain parts of Europe. You've already talked about Hungary. We haven't talked about Venezuela. Certainly China, India. Can you see that all of a sudden the superpowers realign based on energy flow?
I would like to see that. I would like to think that could happen, but I don't think it is. I think what should ideally happen is that we should be realigned on the basis of the freedom that the countries are allowing their people. And I don't see that happening, unfortunately, for the moment. Look, I've covered OPEC conferences back to the 1970s when I was first covered. My first one was in Bali, Indonesia. And I've seen that the power and the control that OPEC was able to exert over much of the world, that's slipping away.
Right.
And I think they realize it's slipping away. And I think this is why a lot of the OPEC countries are starting to look for other vehicles of wielding their power in the world. This is one of the reasons why the Qataris, for instance, have been so involved in trying to make some kind of a, cobble together some kind of a peace in the Middle East involving the Israelis and the Palestinians. They're trying to assert a power that would go beyond simply their ability to manipulate oil markets, or natural gas markets for that matter. So I think that, I would like to think the countries that have vast energy resources will use them responsibly, and not simply try to play politics with them.
Probably won't happen. If I think beyond oil and gas and think about minerals, mining, and batteries, it seems to be a rush between Russia into Africa, China into Africa, not so much U.S. into Africa.
That is something that has driven me nuts. To think that there is this, Biden is the first American president in generations never to have visited Africa, period. Both he and both Putin and Xi Jinping are making tremendous progress. They invite, Xi Jinping just had the rulers of most of the major African nations to Beijing, and they rolled out the red carpet. I mean, they rolled out the red, white, blue, gold, carpet to all of these people. And they made them feel like the princes that they are, in their own countries. And they made them feel that they had a value that no one in the West really has offered many of these leaders in the past. That is a huge mistake in my view.
Yeah, interesting. Do you care to predict what you think ultimately happens in Ukraine? Do you see a conclusion anytime soon?
No. And I'll tell you why. And I was talking about that just this morning, in fact, with someone. Let's assume Trump gets elected. And I try to stay neutral on this. I try to reasonably objective about American politics. In fact, politics everywhere in the world. Because I think a good journalist does that. Let's assume Trump is elected, and he basically turns Ukraine over to Russia. I think that Russia will be fighting a war into eternity. I know the Ukrainian people. I think they will take to the hills and to the Maquis. You know, the Maquis was the French underground, the resistance during World War II. And they would have continued on if the Americans hadn't come and liberated France. The Maquis was prepared to, you know, keep biting back at the Germans, you know, for the thousand-year Reich.
Till their death.
Yeah. I think that's what will happen.
Yeah, interesting. We love to have a little fun on Path to Zero. We're going to hand you a magic wand in just a moment. You can use that magic wand one time for one thing in the next year, so lots of ones, that you think would have the biggest impact on, I'll say climate change, but you could also expand that to journalism around climate change. How would you use that wand?
I thought a lot about that, actually. I knew you were going to ask me that. So I didn't think about journalism. Journalism, what I'd love to see the magic wand is to make people really understand what we do and how really professional journalists have this deep passion for presenting things, the world as it really exists and not how we hope it'll exist. But now this may sound narrow or silly, but in Paris especially, and in New York as well, shop owners all too often keep their doors wide open with their air conditioners blasting. Since 2015, it's been illegal in New York, but why not enforce it? In Paris, it's everywhere. They don't even enforce it. And by the way, if you care about conservation, don't patronize shops that operate in this fashion. Keep your doors closed and keep the air conditioning in and hold down energy consumption.
What a great idea.
Voila. Yeah.
As we Simple say. Ideas yeah. turn into great savings, great conservation. That's a great use of your wand. Thank you. All right, one other fun tradition we have is to honor you for your time here, your expertise with us, all the great work you've shared with us for years, by planting a tree in your honor. And we love to start with you thinking about a national forest. Is there a special place? You've already talked about your home in Pennsylvania. Is there a special place that you would like us to plant a tree?
I have two places. They're both abroad. They're both outside the U.S. One is, there's a disease called the chestnut ink disease. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. It's been ravaging the chestnut forest of Montmorency, just north of Paris. The forest has been dying out. It's now being reversed by efforts to plant disease-resistant trees. So if I had one choice, that would be it. If there was a second, it would be the little tiny Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, whose people my wife and I love. We've been there once. I know the king, the new young king, pretty well. He was at Andover when my son was at Exeter. And in so many ways, they're dependent on their shrinking forest for their livelihood. So they're also trying to replant and reforest parts of Bhutan. So Montmorency or Bhutan?
Well, I smile because our producer, Russ Ray, loves when somebody gives an exotic location like that, because the first thing he has to do is travel there and investigate. So
there you go.
You've given him two great places to go, and we thank you. David Andelman, I encourage everyone to listen to your Substack, Andelman Unleashed. Thank you so much for just a brilliant career, brilliant reporting through a variety of sources, and we look forward to seeing you more and reading more, visiting you on Substack, and thank you for being with us on Path to Zero.
Thank you so much. As I say, I've had a fabulous career, but it's not over yet.
By no means. We can see that.
And tonight I will begin reading Path to Zero, which I hope you will inscribe to me.
I will be honored to do that. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.